simply fools e nada mais.
My name is Iman Shafi. Currently, I'm in my third year of software engineering at McGill. And basically, I started off this project with Paul. And Paul had the idea first of having this sort of barbecue style lunch. And since it's COVID and we couldn't do that, I spoke with Paul and I was like, oh, we should probably instead do something more like, you know, discussions, Zoom discussions instead. And maybe if... hopefully COVID ends a bit later, either this year or next year, then we could actually have this lunch on barbecue in real life. So currently in the US, I'm the publications director. So I was able to work with Paul, as Paul is a VP external of the Ledger, and also work with him with everything that's external. So talking with other groups and helping manage this project.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, how did you get the idea, I guess?
So, hello everyone. My name is Paul. I'm in U2 Mechanical Engineering, and I'm also doing a minor in Comp Sci. And like Iman said, we kind of came up with this idea when I heard in the news over the summer a sort of quote-unquote protest that was happening in rural Ohio. And over there, what was happening was there was a town, I think it was called Belleth or something of the sort. And it was very, very, very high white population over there. And during the Black Lives Matter movement, they were not very receptive to the protests. And in fact, they equated the word protest with terrorism. So what this one lady did is she had the idea of staging her own quote unquote protest, but instead of having an event, you know, like the traditional like walk on the street and like have those chants kind of to get the attention of like the local government. She had the idea of organizing more of like a luncheon or a barbecue where she brought people in to kind of have discussions about Black Lives Matter. And the idea worked because people were more receptive to the idea of, you know, coming for free food, and in doing so, they were more open to having the conversation with others about this topic that was stigmatized. So, in essence, what I had the idea to do was to kind of do the same thing here in Montreal, because we have a heavy number of topics at hand that are stigmatized, and it's not just Black Lives Matter. There are topics such as like, you know, xenophobia. There are topics like homelessness that people just don't talk about because they're uncomfortable talking about. People have the wrong impression about. So I said, hey man, why don't we bring a bunch of people together who have experience dealing with these topics, so that we can have a conversation with the general public about them. And Iman said, you know, that's a great idea, but again, we're in COVID. What if we take this to an online platform instead? And that's kind of how, like Iman said, that's kind of how our project came to be.
How does the social cohesion, you know, that would address a lot of these issues and is the point, is achieved via online?
Yeah, exactly. So at first, those were a lot of questions we asked, which would be, what is the best way to reach out to people, especially if it's online? And we didn't know if a lot of people would come at first. It was such a new idea. And what we did was, first off, just start emailing as many newsletters as we could so that the word could get out. So we set it up as a conversational platform. Normally, it would have been just a presentation of the groups, but we really wanted it to be more of a discussion rather than just a presentation and you're just here listening. We wanted the public to be able to not only know more about those groups, know more about the stigmas, know more about how to make sure that you can add any of your input and know more about all of those groups, their mission, their perspectives, but also make sure that the public can engage and ask questions, because most of the time people have a lot of questions, but they never know who to reach out to. They don't really know if their questions are okay or not. So we wanted to create this safer space afterwards, in the discussion part. So the discussion part, we really wanted to have it more of a questions and answers, but also very open. And when we started, we had our first event with NSBE McGill, and that's the National Society of Black Engineers, the McGill chapter. And we also had US Equity. So US Equity was able to share with us information they had about how to make an event more equitable. Not only more equitable, but also to make sure that it's better presented. And there's more also of everyone could feel safer in this space. They introduced to us this idea that we could use a Google form for questions, for it to be anonymous, especially since people might not be comfortable with some of these topics we're talking about. They might not be comfortable asking questions if people knew their names, etc. So this was a really great way to make sure that more questions could come in without affecting people directly. And when we started this, we reached out to so many people, and we were really impressed by the reactions of the audience. So people thought, oh, this is so new, you know, we haven't had this in engineering for so long. And the question is why, you know, those groups exist, but there's not really a platform that brings them together. And also to make sure that, you know, the public from in engineering, but also outside of engineering could learn more about these groups.
That's actually,
And
oops, I'm sorry, go ahead, Paul.
yeah, no worries. And just to add to what Iman said, and especially addressing your question of how do you bring people together for like how do you, I guess, synthesize the social cohesion that you would normally have in an in-person event. Like Iman said, we put a huge, huge emphasis on the discussion portion, and that wasn't just like how to facilitate discussions within our event themselves, because w for instance, like what we did is we prepared questions like well in advance so that the ball would get rolling as soon as the groups presented themselves. We would be able to ask questions and the audience would be able to engage. But one of the things that we wanted to make sure was that we weren't just here to have a discussion. We were also here to learn how to have a discussion so that this wouldn't be a one-time thing. The people who came to participate at our events would be able to take something away from this, would be able to take away some tools in terms of some tools and some ideas in terms of how to have these discussions and use them in their own lives to help spread any messages that they wanted to spread after having talked to these people with different experiences.
And so what has that response been like? Would you say that you have been successful in that?
Yeah, so especially at the beginning, I think people were very intrigued in such an idea. So we had a lot of people at the beginning, and even if it was a Zoom call, people were still able to come in easily. We started with an Eventbrite so that more information about the event could be found there. And then most of the time, it was a lot of engineering based audience, but we also had a lot of people from any other different faculties, especially once we actually put the event in the SSMU newsletters. That really helped too. And then afterwards, once we started to see that there was more and more people that came in, we started reaching out to groups outside of McGill. So some of the groups we worked with is NSB McGill, US Equity, PAO McGill, which is promoting opportunities for women in engineering. And then afterwards, we reached out to the Period Purse. So that's an organization that helps give menstrual products to those who need them. And we were able to reach out to them outside of McGill so that we could actually have other experiences and other groups that are not necessarily inside of McGill, but still talk about issues that matter. For example, the stigma around menstruation. There's so much stigma around menstruation. There's so much things that people don't quite understand, and it's just not just women, men too, etc. And we were able to show this project that the Period Purse has of giving donations of menstrual products to shelters, etc., to people in McGill, to make sure that not only we were able to showcase what the Period Purse could do, but also to help maybe end those stigmas around menstruation, etc. So since we were able also to get people from outside McGill, I think our audience base grew. And then at the end, I think it was also because it's midterm season around November, etc. People started to come less, but it was still an awesome place to be because the people that came were so engaged that we could have a discussion that could stay on for so much longer than what the event could be. And so many ideas came in. So our last group, we had ACES McGill, and we also had IIC. So ACES is the American Indigenous Society that we have in McGill, the McGill chapter. And then IIC is the Indigenous Inclusion Committee. And what's been really great about that last event is that the panelists came in with so many information, so many new information about how we could help the Indigenous society, and also how to make sure to present an environment that's more inclusive, more representative, to also always put land acknowledgements in, you know, any event, but also just in life, just always thinking that this land isn't ours. And it was, as an experience, I think it was a great way to engage with the public, learn new things. Even if we made this event and organized it, I feel like we learned a lot just by being there, being present, and also interacting with all of these groups.
That's really great. Let's talk a little bit about the topics of the events that you had have so far, because you have a few already for the group. So what have they been? How did you choose to focus on those topics? And also maybe let's open it up about, like, we know that the exam season is coming, but what's coming up in the future that people can still tune into?
Yeah, for sure. So before we get down into the topics, we can briefly mention the structure of the event and like how it runs. So essentially, we ran it every 2 Wednesdays, and we did it at night. So we started at the beginning of October. We finished towards the end of November. So towards the middle of November. So we had our last event just last week. And we had a total of 4 events. The structure of it is we would have a meeting in the background. So 2-3 weeks prior to our events, we would be meeting with the panelists that we had chosen. We would talk to them about what kind of topics they would like to discuss, what kind of nuances they would want to present in terms of the content, and then. So there was a lot of work in the background going into it, and then the rest of the time leading up to each specific event would be very, very dedicated towards promotion. And that's because we're still a tiny project. We don't have a big following, so we wanted to make sure we reached as big of an audience as possible. When we got to the event itself, it would start at 6:30 on Wednesdays, and that's to accommodate as much as we could for people being in online school, as well as people being in different time zones within Canada. We have had participants join from schools in BC, like SFU and UBC. So we wanted to make sure that as much as we could, we accommodated for online school. So we would start at 6:30. We would have the panelists and the participants come in. And then the panelists, they had prepared, and when I say panelists, I mean the groups that are joining us. So we had asked the groups to prepare a deck presentation about who they are, what they do, how you can join them, etc. And they would present, that would take like 15, 20 minutes, depending on how many groups we have, because sometimes we did collaborations.
Yeah, we had a lot of collaborations with other US groups. And basically, we had a great feedback at the beginning, and especially you talked about at the end how there's a lot less people and what we think we could do in the future. So actually, for this semester, our 4 events went pretty great in terms of organization, and every time we could add something different. So at the beginning, we started with Eventbrite, and we saw that it was a lot of organization just for this project. So instead, we thought, oh, we could just put the Zoom link in our Facebook group, and people could simply add on to that very easily. So that was a way to make sure that more people could come in, and it was easier because it was just on Facebook, right? And then afterwards, it was a lot of questions and answers. We wanted to make sure that that part was better made, better understood. So we added this feature about having an exclamation point. And then people, once they put the exclamation point, they could start to speak up if they wanted to. There was the Google form. And then afterwards, people could put in their questions in the Google form and could easily just access them, read them over first, just to make sure that they're not comments that would put people in the discomfort in the actual situation, because we are talking about topics such as imposter syndrome, we're talking about topics such as microaggression, etc. So those are topics that can sometimes bring in misunderstanding, etc. And to make sure that those misunderstandings that happen, we made sure to read the questions beforehand, and then we could actually ask them to the panelists.
Right now, we have decided to end the events for this semester. We had a great agenda in terms of the people who showed up. It was amazing. But we have realized that as the semester went on, we saw that there were fewer and fewer people who were showing up. So we had to work a lot harder in terms of promotion. And that's not that's to no one's fault. It's more because, Iman said, people are busy with midterms. So we have decided to continue for the next semester instead. So right now we're working towards reaching out to other groups in terms of preparing new presentations and preparing new events. So just like we did last summer. And we are thinking of doing, for instance, of making our project more top heavy in terms of having more people, more events come in at the beginning of the semester, so that instead of spreading them out so that people can attend towards the end, maybe just have more at the beginning. That way we have more participation because people are less busy with finals, for instance. But in essence, we recognize that we're still a pretty small group. So the main things that we are working on is preparing the presentation and the groups joining us for the next semester, as well as trying as much as we can to increase our engagement and social media presence, to build our following for the future as well.
Do let us know if we can help. A number of years ago, we were covering various McGill groups, and one of whom was Queer Engineers. And that's, we're talking about 10 years ago. So things were quite different then. And even the way that the group was meeting on campus and facilitating social events was also quite different. We covered it a few times and tried to promote it. But at a time, I guess, there wasn't even as much safety in doing things in a certain way. And so I'm wondering if you have found that potentially doing it online maybe provided safety that is not necessarily as easily found when you have to do things in person. I don't know if, not to find silver lining to the pandemic, but maybe this medium offers something, especially when you can fill out a survey beforehand, where you can for sure take time to consult reading material, where you can do a little bit of preparation and then attend in a certain format. If that addresses the needs and provides the safety that, students wouldn't necessarily achieve otherwise. I don't know if you have any analysis around that.
Yeah, I think I can start off with my opinion of how the events went as they're online. And Paul, if you want to jump in anytime too with your opinions on it. I think personally, it was great because we had a lot of people that could come in from different places around the world, different places in Montreal, but also in Quebec, etc. So it was a lot more accessible, the fact that it's online. In terms of it being a safer environment, for sure, the idea that EOS Equity brought onto us with the Google Forms helped a lot with that, just to make sure that, questions that are insensitive might not come up in the chat, especially talking with these topics. So I think personally, it's been a great experience to have it online. In terms of how the event could have been in person, I think in person, it would have been a lot more organization with McGill, because we would have had to, book a room and then plan everything to make sure not only it's secure or safe. Some things could have happened during the event in person that we never could have anticipated. Whereas in this space online, we're in control of the interface. We're in control of the Zoom call. If anyone is being disrespectful, then we can take them out of the Zoom call really easily just by click. So I think that's one of the silver lining we could have with this. I don't know, Paul, if you want to add anything too.
Yeah, for sure. What Iman said was entirely correct. I do think that like both of you mentioned, the fact that it was an online platform, it did add an element of comfort in terms of not only the people presenting, but also, as Iman said, the people asking questions. However, there is another element to it, and I hate to be a bit more pessimistic here, but I do think this is some real analysis that we have taken into account, and that is the fact that while the online platform has made things more comfortable, it has made the situation more comfortable for people who are quite frankly already a bit educated on these topics. So one thing that we notice is that the spaces that we were creating through our events were to provide a space for people to have discussions, and I think that was very great. It was amazing. But one thing that I personally noticed was that a lot of the same the demographic themselves was a lot of people who were were there, and they had already had experience with the topics that we were touching on. For instance, I think with our meeting with PAL, which is promoting opportunities for women in engineering, aside from me, if I remember correctly, we had only one other male participant, and the rest were women. And again, it was amazing to create the space for people to share experiences, for people to share opinions. But in my opinion, the goal that we had set out for this summer was for people to come in and learn about experiences that they weren't really part of. While a byproduct of this, like we said, was that it created this opportunity for women students in engineering to share their experiences about what it's like to be a woman in engineering. It didn't really accomplish the goal as much as we had hoped of men gaining that perspective, right? So I do think that one element, part of the quote unquote comfort that you're talking about is the fact that a lot of the people who were coming to these events were coming with an already half formed idea of what it's like to talk about these experiences. So this is definitely one of the goals that we're working towards next semester, to increase our engagement, because our goal is really to provide this opportunity to have conversations to the people who have never really thought about these issues before, who've had the privilege of, for instance, not having to deal with indigenous issues, or who have had the privilege of not feeling like a woman in engineering. So this is one of the big goals that we're setting out for our event series next semester.
Well, that's incredibly tough because how do you resonate with folks who, like you said, never had to think about it?
Even the event, like how we present it, if they're not interested in it, then they probably won't join. So that's another issue we'll have to, discuss and think about. Exactly, yeah.
And I do think that is one of the tougher things about having this event series being online, because oftentimes, when events are advertised on campus, when events are promoted on campus, there's a human element to it, where for instance, we can take any career fair, at career fairs, often what'll happen is, companies are tabling, and you talk to them, and they say, "Hey, we have this workshop coming up, next week, and we're going to be talking about, opportunities that we have and whatnot." And they really engage with you, and they say, "Okay, this is what's going to be happening at our workshop. These are the details that we're going to be going over, and that's to accomplish this, this, and this." Whereas, and in the same way, when we're promoting events in person, it's kind of the same idea. There's a lot more word of mouth. There's a lot more, conversation with the people who are promoting, with the people who are going to be at the event. So it's still hard, but it's a lot easier to connect with people, because you're not looking at a screen, you know, you're not reading like an event page on a screen. You're more getting actual human input about what's going to be at the event. So like we said, like I think it's if we do end up next semester having created another series of events that, you know, provide a safer space for people to have these discussions, it will be an amazing thing. And I will be able to say that we've done a good job. But in terms of like the goals that we had set out last summer, and that's to bring people without having these experiences, who have not had these experiences, if that was our goal, that goal would not have really been accomplished.
So, looking at next semester, have you started thinking about the topics that you would like to organize the series about?
Yeah, so especially I want to add that for next semester, just to start it off, by the end of this semester, there's going to be an event that's called the Conference of Diversity in Engineering. And I reach out to them and ask them if we could come in and learn from that conference so that we could apply it to our Rewrite Your Narrative experience. And the US was really, interested in our event. So they thought, yes, if representatives from your group could join in, that'd be awesome. So I'll be going there to learn more about that and probably apply what they do because the people that host that event, they work in diversity and engineering subjects to make sure that there's more diversity in engineering. Because in engineering, it might seem like there's a lot of diversity, but a lot of words or a lot of topics aren't talked about. They're almost taboo. Even when you go into a room and there's two other women and there's like 100 other men in class, no one really talks about it. Except when you go into groups like PAL, etc., and when PAL reaches out, like inside the class, you don't really talk about these issues, about the fact that there's not a lot of minorities in engineering, even if we think there might be a lot, but there's not that much. The gap between genders, etc., and any other issues, there's not a lot of indigenous students. And all of that, I feel like this initiative, we could bring out, those taboo ideas, those words that aren't really talked about in class in this safer space, so that people don't feel like it's difficult to talk about these issues, but it's more of an open space to talk about it and make sure that everyone learns a bit more. And I think in the future, what we could do is reach out to even other groups that we haven't been able to reach out to this semester. For example, Queer Engineer, as you talked about, we tried to reach out to them, but in the end, we couldn't add them in our events. So that'd be awesome if we could have them. And then another idea we had with Paul and with everyone that's involved in the project was to have actually design groups. So to have design groups in the discussion because we'd like to know from the design group's perspective, is there any, issues that come up in design groups? Do you feel like even the topics we talked about before, feminism, allyship, etc., outreach, even imposter syndrome, does that happen in design groups? Are design groups more like a family that you've built up, or do you feel like some things are happening there? So I think that would be interesting to have those two.
Absolutely. And also maybe the idea of partnering up with student resources on campus like QPerg,
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
like because they do regular, like I mean that's when we'll be able to get back to campus one day. They do organize visibility fairs for their programming, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So, reaching out and
Reaching out
getting
to
a
them.
table, just like Paul was saying, and trying to reach as many people as possible. But also, it's hard, and you're doing it, right? So
Exactly.
it's hard in everywhere in life, right? Like oftentimes, you end up making the space safer from a level of safety already, right? It's very
Exactly, yeah.
hard to jump into like an entirely uninformed, unsafe environment and start making it safer. That's very, very hard. So we're really excited about
Awesome.
this,
That's great.
absolutely.
Thank
And
you. Yeah.
we'll do what we can, with our networks to promote
Yeah, that'd be
your
awesome.
events once you
The
have a
event.
bit of a structure going for next semester. Definitely keep in touch. When will you have, like, how can people find out about your events who are maybe not already part of the networks that you would outreach in currently?
Yeah, exactly. Paul, if you want to take that one too.
Yeah, for sure. So right now, the best way to reach out to us would probably be through our Facebook page. We're very active in organizing with it. So you can find us at the Facebook page is called Rewrite Your Narrative, and then : A New Perspective on Diversity. You can just reach out to us there, give us a follow, check out our past event videos, or just simply message us if you would like to get involved. We'd love to get in touch with you. Otherwise, if you're not on Facebook, we're currently working on developing our website. But also, you can reach out to us through Instagram, and that's that would be through the Plumber's Ledger. So the Ledger is a U.S. publication at McGill. Articles come out, or issues come out, with a variety of articles every month. And since Iman and I are actually part of the Ledger, we actually organized Rewrite Your Narrative through the Plumber's Ledger this semester, and that's what we'll be doing next semester as well. So that's where all of our Instagram promotion has been coming from. So yeah, either Facebook through our page directly, or you can find the Plumber's Ledger on Instagram. Shoot us a DM there. Otherwise, like we said, keep an eye out for our website coming up soon.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for making the time.
Thank you. It was really nice talking to you.
Yeah, it was a great conversation.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
This is a forum that's open to everyone. It might seem like it's only for McGill students, but it's really open for everyone. So if you're listening to this and you're not at McGill, any other university, or outside of Montreal, then we're really, really excited for what's to come. And we're really very open to anyone to come into the discussion and talk, because this is really what this is about. It's about, you know, a community of students that come in, but also people from outside the student community to give us different perspective, because this is what we're looking for, different perspectives, different opinions on issues that matter. And also, just as a little furthermore into the discussion, a lot of people sometimes aren't comfortable with speaking about the issue, but rather than speaking about it, they like writing about it. So with the Ledger, what's really great is you can send in your submissions to ledger@mcgillus.ca, and we take in any kind of submission. So if you have any opinion pieces about, let's say, one of the Rewrite Your Narrative initiative, then you can easily just send it to us and we'll be able to publish it if you're not comfortable with the whole discussion and talking about it in real life. But yeah, we're excited for the future, and we really hope that a lot of more people can learn more about these issues to make sure that hopefully we can talk topics that are sometimes misunderstood, and maybe make sure that those topics get understood, and so that the groups that actually talk about those topics could inform the population better, and that we all come out of that, you know, learning something new.
For sure. And I think Iman summed it up very, very well. And again, just like a big emphasis on if you're part of a group, or if you're leading a group, who has, you know, a different perspective, a different set of experiences, go ahead and message us. You can find us on Facebook or on Instagram, like we said. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to have you on our platform. We'd love to engage with you. And like Iman said, it doesn't matter if you're or if you're even in engineering. We've had engagement with other schools such as SFU and UBC in BC. We've also had engagement with schools like Queen's University and Concordia. So for us, it's like experience is experience. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love for you to share your experience with our audience. So feel free to reach out to us.
It's so hard to get. directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID. Rendez-vous dès maintenant sur québec.ca/alerte-covid pour obtenir plus de renseignements sur l'application et apprendre comment la télécharger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
To today's special alumni webcast, Managing Anxiety During a Pandemic. It feels like a title that could be ripped straight from your favorite science fiction novel. And yet this is a situation most of us find ourselves in today as we hunker down and wait out the COVID-19 outbreak. I'm Derek Kassoff, Managing Director of Communications at McGill's Office of University Advancement, greeting you once again from the safety of my basement, my new home office. It's Thursday, March 26th, and I'm fortunate to be joined today, also remotely, by two of McGill's experts on anxiety, stress, and we hope some coping mechanisms for all of us. We have with us Dr. Tina Montroy, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational and Counseling Psychology at McGill's Faculty of Education, associate member of the Department of Psychiatry and the Faculty of Medicine, and director of McGill's CARE Research Lab, which stands for Childhood Anxiety and Regulation of Emotions. Welcome, Tina. Dr. Montroy. And we have Dr. Jason Harley, an assistant professor in the Department of Surgery, junior scientist at the Research Institute of the McGill University Health Center, and director of the Sales Lab, which stands for Simulation, Affect, Innovation, Learning, and Surgery. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for taking time out of your days to join this alumni webcast and answer some questions from the McGill community. We have received many questions, as you might imagine, in the last 48 hours from alumni all over the world, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can during the time we have together. Hopefully, people will walk away from this session with some specific actions they can take in their own lives as they cope with the COVID-19 pandemic. But before we get too far into the subject, I'd like to find out a little bit more about each of you and some of your areas of research here at McGill. Dr. Montroy, let's start with you. What are some of the aspects of psychology and human nature that your team focuses on at McGill?
Yes. So thank you first for having me. So a lot of the research that we conduct at McGill involves obviously emotion regulation and anxiety, as the title stands for. I think a lot of our concerns focuses on preventative measures. Currently, we are getting knowledgeable about ways to reverse the effect of anxiety once there is a problem. But a lot of our lab's effort seeks to essentially build resilience from a young age, children, to ensure that in the face of adversity, similar to what we're experiencing now, that we can actually build individuals that are stronger, more resilient, better at coping with adversity. And a lot of our efforts as well is working with parents in better equipping them to become better model, and we'll talk about that later, become better model of resiliency for their children, how to manage and cope with adverse situation, such as the pandemic would represent currently. So overall, a lot of our efforts are focused on those two kinds of areas of research.
Great. So in many ways, the entire world has become your laboratory these last couple of weeks. And we'll definitely talk a lot about that, including the children's aspect as well today. Dr. Harley, welcome. I'm not sure I've ever before come across a scientist with a PhD in educational psychology who's posted to the Department of Surgery. Can you tell us a bit about how all that fits together and what expertise you bring to your unit and to the Faculty of Medicine at McGill?
Well, first, thanks so much for having me, Derek. And ultimately, what the goal that my lab and myself are pursuing is how we can harness emotions to help people learn, train, and perform most effectively. In the context of training surgeons and healthcare providers, what we want is for people to be best able to manage all the stresses that are associated with the healthcare system. For patients, what we're interested in is trying to help them do their best to understand themselves and their loved ones, medical conditions, treatment options, et cetera, so they can help make good and informed decisions as well as follow-ups. And so training and emotion regulation, no surprise, is of course going to be critically important in handling the pandemic as well. So in other words, a big part of what we're doing is to try to help with psychological readiness. And this is really a tool set that in healthcare, we need to be doing lots of work on. And so we're happy to be engaged in that work.
Great, great. Thank you so much. And thank you again for joining us today. We're certainly living in interesting times, to say the least. Dr. Montroy, if I were to ask you to go back in time to find another moment in history where practically the entire population of the world was living under such widespread anxiety and uncertainty, how far back would you need to go?
Well, historically, it's funny because about a few hours ago, the BBC put together sort of a history perspective of pandemics. I think critically, there's been every centuries an episode similar to what we're experiencing. I think this is not a novel thing. I think what makes it currently more of a pressing issue is definitely the aspect of media. So we're connected real time on news all the way across the world. So I think there's more of an urgency, or there's definitely more of a, we're more alarmed by the fact that we're not just aware of what's going on in our immediate sort of geographical location, but we're also aware, we're able to pair what's happening here with what's happening abroad. And so I think that's what probably causes more anxiety currently, even though it is historically something that other generations have experienced. And secondly, I think the other issue is also the fact that we're in an era where we live longer. We are really focused on living healthier, longer lives. We're not as, our perspective of death or how we react to death is, I think, not as, it's less familiar to us. It, you know, if we look at, for example, pandemics that have occurred 100 years ago, people were, I'm not saying that they were used to, you know, death, but they were, I guess, possibly less reactive than we are now. So tying with certain things that Dr. Harley presented before, it's really, and we're going to talk about that a lot now with regards to how we manage this anxiety regarding the pandemic, it's really a question of perspective. So I think right now we are exposed to more content that fuels the anxiety. And also I think we are less used to, for example, seeing these kinds of things occurring on a global global platform. I don't know if Dr. Harley would have anything to add to that.
Yeah, well, I was going to sort of maybe ask Dr. Harley to jump in. I mean, so it is clear from your answer that in unless you're 102 years old, none of us have ever lived through anything like this in terms of a pandemic. Again, you know, maybe the Spanish flu, which was pre-Facebook, Instagram time. But Dr. Harley, the fact that we have never lived through any of this, and it is unprecedented, how does that make it even more challenging for all of us to be able to cope with this for the first time in all of our lives?
I think Dr. Montreuil made some really excellent points. And to kind of pick up on one of those, for sure, we're dealing with a huge quantity of information. It's easier for people to create information and for misinformation to not only be created and look more credible, but also for it to spread. And so one of the things that we've been paying more attention to in various scientific and public domains is the role of media literacy and relatedly health literacy. And so we need to be working with patients to provide them with tools to critically evaluate the information that they're using to make decisions about how they, for example, pursue different types of medical treatments or avoid pursuing some. And it's the same thing with COVID. And I know we'll talk a bit about that later. The second part is that we need to be focusing and kind of buckling down and making some commitments with regards to our healthcare providers' professional and personal well-being. This is something, burnout is a huge issue among healthcare providers. And this is something that's important for us to be thinking of as not only those of us in the healthcare system, but also as patients when we go and see our healthcare providers, that it's important for us to try to be empathetic and constructive. And we'll talk a little bit about that later.
Well, in fact, I'm glad you brought that up. I know you did want to speak about that. Let's jump into that right now, if that's all right. This whole notion of healthcare providers, I mean, they are obviously working on the front lines, putting their own health and well-being at risk to in the service of others. And yet I imagine they're also at the receiving end of a lot of fear and anxiety coming from patients or from the loved ones of patients. Tell us a little bit more about what life is like for a healthcare provider now, and perhaps what is it we should be mindful of and what can we do when we are dealing with them, whether it's over the phone or in person?
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, a large part of my lab and my focus is to work on emotion and enhancing well-being in health in the healthcare system. And that a lot of that stems from a large incidence unfortunately, an increasing incidence of burnout amongst healthcare providers. And as we know, burnout is associated with emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, decreased sense of personal accomplishment. And the numbers of this have been going up within our healthcare professions. And this is a problem because it reduces the efficiency of our healthcare system, as well as in some cases, the retention of our healthcare workers. Of course, COVID-19 is making that even harder. Our healthcare professionals are working really hard to create new medical protocols, to be creative and responsible and adaptive. They're also dealing with reduced staff as some people go into quarantine, limited resources, as in some cases, some things are being hoarded, unfortunately, as well as concerns over their loved ones, their own health. And of course, as you mentioned, when patients are anxious, that certainly makes it harder for us. Whenever we can all probably appreciate that or remember that, when we're feeling stressed, our interactions with other people tend to not be as patient as they might otherwise be, and it's easier to be grumpy and angry. And so it's important that we're mindful of that going into these settings.
So any specific advice for people dealing with healthcare workers in a frontline setting?
Absolutely. The first thing is that, of course, it's important to acknowledge that we all have emotions and it's okay to be anxious. What's important is that we don't let that carry over to how we're dealing with the people who are trying to help us. And they really do care. Healthcare professionals are there. It's a very vocational job and they care a lot. So please try to, again, you know, it's normal to be anxious. Try to avoid letting that come out in our interactions with healthcare providers because they're also dealing with anxiety themselves. Saying thank you, it's an easy thing to do, and it goes a long way when people are dealing potentially with burnout and increased demands, et cetera. Showing them that we see that, we recognize and value the hard work and the sacrifices that they're making, that can go a long way and be a highlight of a day in some cases. Following instructions is something else that we can do. There's for non-healthcare professionals, our main job is to make sure that we're following the advice that comes from Health Canada and our governments. And by doing this, that we're doing our part. And that's something as well that helps when we go into hospitals as well, that, for example, we read the instructions. We don't come with, you know, five people, for example, for a hospital visit, because then we're going to be asked to only have, you know, one person stay with us. So reading those rules, for example, will help to make sure that everything flows smoothly. And that it reduces also the potential for there to be, you know, potential conflicts, for example, with people having to tell you, which is a hard thing, of course, to say to people, to ask them, you know, some people to wait in the car or to go back home. And not hoarding resources as well. One of the sources, of course, of stress for healthcare workers right now is working with less materials. Many of us have heard really heart-wrenching stories that have come out of Italy and other countries where healthcare providers are having to make really difficult decisions between, you know, which patient will have a respirator or a ventilator. And so by not hoarding resources, we can help healthcare providers to have the resources they need to help us. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly to everyone's advantages.
Great. Excellent advice. Thank you for that. Dr. Montroy, I'm going to maybe circle back and ask you a more fundamental question. So I've noticed in sort of, you know, my own circle of friends and in following things on the news, there seems to be a tremendously varied reaction to people's responses to the pandemic. So we've got people who are not leaving their homes to get groceries without suiting up in hazmat suits. And then you've got others, we see all these pictures of people hanging out on the beach in Florida on spring break. I guess my question to you is why is that? And how is it that humans could be wired so differently from one another to respond to crises such as this one?
Yes. Well, it goes back to a point that Dr. Harley brought up, which is the issue of anxiety. Anxiety being a normal emotion. A lot of the times when I see patients in private practice, they come to us and they're like, okay, I want to get rid of my anxiety. And one of the first things we teach individuals is that anxiety serves a purpose. And I've prepared a stress curve to sort of illustrate what might be going on, if it can be brought up onto the screen. But essentially what it shows is that, you know, no anxiety is, or no stress is not necessarily a good thing, because it basically makes us basically indifferent. It makes us sort of not take what's being presented to us by public health as being something that we should abide by, that we should respect, such as confinement. You're referring to people being on the beaches. So most likely these people would be on the latter end, the very low end of anxiety and stress. And so therefore that's not necessarily a very viable thing, because we're probably putting ourselves and others at risk. By the same token, too much anxiety, which sometimes we refer to as neurotic anxiety or chronic anxiety, will also be, not enable us to be able to make wise decisions. We were talking before about the hoarding and, you know, the sometimes the harsh behaviors that people have been presenting in the media as well, like with, you know, just at grocery stores, for example. The idea is that too much anxiety can cause irritability, hostility. And so as a result, I think it's really critical to not get rid of all anxiety and not necessarily see it as a normal thing, but at the same time, be able to manage. Now, in terms of your question, how come the level of anxiety varies across individuals? I think because we are programmed that way. There's a biophysiological explanation to that, and there's also more like environmental or a modeling one, which is it all depends how we are born genetically. And so we do know that children of parents who were themselves anxious are more likely to be more sensitive, so have a lower threshold to stress, so be more reactive. And we do know as well that children that are raised environmental also effects and influences is that in our lab studies, that is essentially if I have a very anxious parent, I will model those types of behavior to children. And so it's kind of like the combination of the genetic vulnerability or predisposition, along with, you know, the modeling that will create a lot of times that variability amongst individuals in terms of anxiety sensitivity. So that's why it's really critical right now to inform parents on the benefits of how we ourselves are dealing with anxiety, so that we, you know, we reflect to our children an image of resilience and ability to cope, so that themselves feel reassured and secured through our own managing of life events.
Great. I will add no personal comments to your parental anxiety piece there. I do want to jump into some of the questions we received. I'm going to start with one from Jeannie Kavanaugh. I'm going to start with it not only because hers came with a whole bunch of question marks and a freaked out emoji, but because I think it taps into a lot of the fear and anxiety that many of us are experiencing. So here's her question. Every time I have to go food shopping, I take the necessary precautions, mask, gloves, washing my hands upon my return home, but I still fear that I can get COVID-19. When you hear that the virus can live for days on certain surfaces, how do you deal with that? And if you'd like, before we jump into that, maybe we'll just have that conversation within the framework of the media, because you mentioned that, Dr. Montroy, that this is the first pandemic of this scope in a world of media and social media that we've never had before. And I'm hoping we can get into that a little bit. So I guess to frame Jeannie's question a certain way, you know, what is the solution or the right balance that we should strike between staying informed about what's going on in the world versus letting ourselves be driven mad, you know, by hour after hour of grim news? And can headlines that we read impact our ability to think critically and make rational decisions? Maybe I'll turn it over to you guys to answer that.
So maybe, Dr. Harley, I'll just start with just more like what goes on in the brain and how we kind of need to psychologically perceive or deal with what you're presenting, and maybe you could.
The spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. more targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing isn't possible. We need to act now. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.